This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank, edited by Otto H. Frank and Miriam Pressler, and translated by Susan Masati. Read for you by Selma Blair. Forward. Anne Frank kept a diary from June 12, 1942 to August 1, 1944. Initially, she wrote it strictly for herself. Then, one day in 1944, Gerrit Bolkestein, a member of the Dutch government in exile, announced in a radio broadcast from London that after the war, he hoped to collect eyewitness accounts of the suffering of the Dutch people under the German occupation, which could be made available to the public. As an example, he specifically mentioned letters and diaries. Impressed by this speech, Anne Frank decided that when the war was over, she would publish a book based on her diary. She began rewriting and editing her diary, improving on the text, omitting passages she didn't think were interesting enough, and adding others from memory. At the same time, she kept up her original diary. In the scholarly work, The Diary of Anne Frank, the critical edition, 1989, Anne's first unedited diary is referred to as version A, to distinguish it from her second, edited diary, which is known as version B. The last entry in Anne's diary is dated August 1, 1944. On August 4, 1944, the 8 people hiding in the secret annex were arrested. Miep Gies and Bep Foskel, the 2 secretaries working in the building, found Anne's diary strewn all over the floor. Miep Gies tucked them away in a desk drawer for safekeeping. After the war, when it became clear that Anne was dead, she gave the diaries, unread, to Anne's father, Otto Frank. After long deliberation, Otto Frank decided to fulfill his daughter's wish and publish her diary. He selected material from versions A and B, editing them into a shorter version later referred to as version C. Readers all over the world know this as The Diary of a Young Girl. In making his choice, Otto Frank had to bear several points in mind. To begin with, the book had to be kept short, so that it would fit in with a series put out by the Dutch publisher. In addition, several passages dealing with Anne's sexuality were omitted. At the time of the diary's initial publication, in 1947, it was not customary to write openly about sex, and certainly not in books for young adults. Out of respect for the dead, Otto Frank also omitted a number of unflattering passages about his wife and the other residents of the secret annex. Anne Frank, who was 13 when she began her diary, and 15 when she was forced to stop, wrote without reserve about her likes and dislikes. When Otto Frank died in 1980, he willed his daughter's manuscripts to the Netherlands State Institute for War Documentation in Amsterdam. Because the authenticity of the diary had been challenged ever since its publication, the Institute for War Documentation ordered a thorough investigation. Once the diary was proved, beyond a shadow of a doubt, to be genuine, it was published in its entirety, along with the results of an exhaustive study. The critical edition contains not only versions A, B, and C, but also articles on the background of the Frank family, the circumstances surrounding their arrest and deportation, and the examination into Anne's handwriting, the document, and the materials used. The Anne Frank Fonds, Anne Frank Foundation, in Basel, Switzerland, which, as Otto Frank's legal heir, had inherited his daughter's copyrights, then decided to have a new, expanded edition of the diary published for general readers. This new edition in no way affects the integrity of the old one, originally edited by Otto Frank, which brought the diary and its message to millions of people. The task of compiling the expanded edition was given to the writer and translator, Miriam Pressler. Otto Frank's original selection has now been supplemented with passages from Anne's A and B versions. Miriam Pressler's definitive edition, approved by the Anne Frank Fonds, contains approximately 30% more material and is intended to give the reader more insight into the world of Anne Frank. In 1998, the existence of 5 previously unknown pages of the diary came to light. Now with the permission of the Anne Frank Fonds in Basel, a long passage dated February 8, 1944, has been added to the end of the already existing entry of that date. A short alternative to the entry of June 20, 1942, has not been included here because a more detailed version of it is already part of the diary. Furthermore, in line with recent findings, the entry of November 7, 1942 has been moved to October 30, 1943. For more information, the reader is referred to the revised critical edition. In writing her second version, B, Anne invented pseudonyms for the people who would appear in her book. She initially wanted to call herself Anne Aulis, and later Anne Robin. Otto Frank opted to call his family by their own names and to follow Anne's wishes with regard to the others. Over the years, the identity of the people who helped the families in the secret annex has become common knowledge. In this edition, the helpers are now referred to by their real names as they so justly deserve to be. All other persons are named in accordance with the pseudonyms in the critical edition. The Institute for War Documentation has arbitrarily assigned initials to those persons wishing to remain anonymous. The real names of the other people hiding in the secret annex are the Van Pels family, from Osnabrück, Germany. August Van Pels, born September 9, 1900. Hermann Van Pels, born March 31, 1898. Peter Van Pels, born November 8, 1926. Called by Anne in her manuscript, Petronella, Hans, and Alfred Van Dan, and in the book, Petronella, Hermann, and Peter Van Dan. Fritz Pfeffer, born April 30th, 1889, in Gießen, Germany. Called by Anne in her manuscript and in the book, Albert Dussel. The listener may wish to bear in mind that much of this edition is based on the B version of Anne's diary, which she wrote when she was around 15 years old. Occasionally, Anne went back and commented on a passage she had written earlier. These comments are clearly marked in this edition. Naturally, Anne's spelling and linguistic errors have been corrected. Otherwise, the text has basically been left as she wrote it, since any attempts at editing and clarification would be inappropriate in a historical document. I hope I will be able to confide everything to you, as I have never been able to confide in anyone, and I hope you will be a great source of comfort and support. June 12, 1942. I hope I will be able to confide everything to you, as I have never been able to confide in anyone, and I hope you will be a great source of comfort and support. Comment added by Anne on September 28, 1942. So far, you truly have been a great source of comfort to me, and so is Kitty, whom I now write to regularly. This way of keeping a diary is much nicer, and now I can hardly wait for those moments when I'm able to write in you. Oh, I'm so glad I brought you along. Sunday, June 14, 1942. I'll begin from the moment I got you. The moment I saw you lying on the table among my other birthday presents. I went along when you were bought, but that doesn't count. On Friday, June 12th, I was awake at 6 o'clock, which isn't surprising since it was my birthday, but I'm not allowed to get up at that hour, so I had to control my curiosity until 6:45. When I couldn't wait any longer, I went to the dining room where Murcia, the cat, welcomed me by rubbing against my legs. A little after 7, I went to Daddy and Mama, and then to the living room to open my presents, and you were the first thing I saw, maybe one of my nicest presents, then a bouquet of roses, some peonies, and a potted plant. From Daddy and Mama, I got a blue blouse, a game, a bottle of grape juice, which to my mind tastes a bit like wine. After all, wine is made from grapes. A puzzle, a jar of cold cream, 2.5 guilders, and a gift certificate for 2 books. I got another book as well, Camera Obscura, but Margot already has it, so I exchanged mine for something else. A platter of homemade cookies, which I made myself, of course, since I've become quite an expert at baking cookies. Lots of candy, and a strawberry tart from Mother. And a letter from Grammy, right on time. But, of course, that was just a coincidence. Then Hanalei came to pick me up, and we went to school. During recess, I passed out cookies to my teachers and my class, and then it was time to get back to work. I didn't arrive home until 5, since I went to gym with the rest of the class. I'm not allowed to take part because my shoulders and hips tend to get dislocated. As it was my birthday, I got to decide which game my classmates would play, and I chose volleyball. Afterward, they all danced around me in a circle and sang happy birthday. When I got home, Sanna Lederman was already there. Ilse Wagner, Hanalee Gosler, and Jacqueline Van Marsen came home with me after gym, since we're in the same class. Hanalee and Sanna used to be my two best friends. People who saw us together used to say, "There goes Anne, Hannah, and Sanna." I only met Jacqueline Van Marsen when I started at the Jewish Lyceum, and now she's my best friend. Ilse is Hanalee's best friend, and Sanna goes to another school and has friends there. They gave me a beautiful book, Dutch Sagas and Legends, but they gave me Volume 2 by mistake, so I exchanged two other books for Volume 1. Aunt Helene brought me a puzzle, Aunt Stephanie a darling brooch, and Aunt Lenny a terrific book, Daisy Goes to the Mountains. This morning I lay in the bathtub thinking how wonderful it would be if I had a dog like Rin Tin Tin. I'd call him Rin Tin Tin too, and I'd take him to school with me, where he could stay in the janitor's room or by the bicycle racks when the weather was good. Monday, June 15th, 1942. I had my birthday party on Sunday afternoon. The Rin Tin Tin movie was a big hit with my classmates. I got two brooches, a bookmark, and two books. I'll start by saying a few things about my school and my class, beginning with the students. Betty Blumendahl looks kind of poor, and I think she probably is. She lives on some obscure street in West Amsterdam, and none of us know where it is. She does very well at school, but that's because she works so hard, not because she's so smart. She's pretty quiet. Jacqueline Van Marsen is supposedly my best friend, but I've never had a real friend. At first I thought Jacques would be one, but I was badly mistaken. DQ is a very nervous girl who's always forgetting things, so the teachers keep assigning her extra homework as punishment. She's very kind, especially to Jeezy. ES talks so much, it isn't funny. She's always touching your hair or fiddling with your buttons when she asks you something. They say she can't stand me, but I don't care, since I don't like her much either. Henny Metz is a nice girl with a cheerful disposition, except that she talks in a loud voice and is really childish when we're playing outdoors. Unfortunately, Henny has a girlfriend named Beppy, who's a bad influence on her because she's dirty and vulgar. JR. I could write a whole book about her. Jay is a detestable, sneaky, stuck-up, two-faced gossip who thinks she's so grown up. She's really got Jock under her spell, and that's a shame. Jay is easily offended, bursts into tears at the slightest thing, and to top it all off is a terrible show-off. Miss Jay always has to be right. She's very rich and has a closet full of the most adorable dresses that are way too old for her. She thinks she's gorgeous, but she's not. Jay and I can't stand each other. Ilse Wagner is a nice girl with a cheerful disposition, but she's extremely finicky and can spend hours moaning and groaning about something. Ilse likes me a lot. She's very smart, but lazy. Hanalee Gosler, or Lise, as she's called at school, is a bit on the strange side. She's usually shy, outspoken at home, but reserved around other people. She blabs whatever you tell her to her mother, but she says what she thinks, and lately I've come to appreciate her a great deal. Nanny Van Praag-Siegert is small, funny, and sensible. I think she's nice. She's pretty smart. There isn't much else you can say about Nanny. Effie de Jong is, in my opinion, terrific. Though she's only 12, she's quite the lady. She acts as if I were a baby. She's also very helpful, and I like her. Jeezy is the prettiest girl in our class. She has a nice face, but is kind of dumb. I think they're going to hold her back a year, but of course, I haven't told her that. Comment added by Anne at a later date. To my great surprise, Jeezy wasn't held back a year after all. And sitting next to Jeezy is the last of us 12 girls, me. There's a lot to be said about the boys, or maybe not so much after all. Maurice Koster is one of my many admirers, but pretty much of a pest. Sally Springer has a filthy mind, and rumor has it that he's gone all the way. Still, I think he's terrific because he's very funny. Emil Bonavit is Jeezy's admirer, but she doesn't care. He's pretty boring. Rob Cohen used to be in love with me, too, but I can't stand him anymore. He's an obnoxious, two-faced, lying, sniveling little goof who has an awfully high opinion of himself. Max Vandeveld is a farm boy from Medemblik, but a decent sort, as Margot would say. Hermann Koopman also has a filthy mind, just like Yopi de Beer, who's a terrible flirt and absolutely girl-crazy. Leo Blom is Yopi de Beer's best friend, but has been ruined by his dirty mind. Albert de Mesquita came from the Montessori school and skipped a grade. He's really smart. Leo Slegger came from the same school, but isn't as smart. Ruth Stoppelman is a short, goofy boy from El Melo, who transferred to this school in the middle of the year. CN does whatever he's not supposed to. Jacques Coconut sits behind us, next to C, and we, G and I, laugh ourselves silly. Harry Schapp is the most decent boy in our class. He's nice. Werner Josef is nice, too, but all the changes taking place lately have made him too quiet, so he seems boring. Sam Solomon is one of those tough guys from across the tracks, a real brat. Admirer. Appy Ream is pretty orthodox, but a brat, too. Saturday, June 20th, 1942. Writing in a diary is a really strange experience for someone like me, not only because I've never written anything before, but also because it seems to me that later on neither I nor anyone else will be interested in the musings of a 13-year-old schoolgirl. Oh well, it doesn't matter. I feel like writing, and I have an even greater need to get all kinds of things off my chest. Paper has more patience than people. I thought of this saying on one of those days when I was feeling a little depressed and was sitting at home with my chin in my hands, bored and listless, wondering whether to stay in or go out. I finally stayed where I was, brooding. Yes, paper does have more patience, and since I'm not planning to let anyone else read this stiff-backed notebook grandly referred to as a diary, unless I should ever find a real friend, it probably won't make a bit of difference. Now I'm back to the point that prompted me to keep a diary in the first place. I don't have a friend. Let me put it more clearly, since no one will believe that a 13-year-old girl is completely alone in the world. And I'm not. I have loving parents and a 16-year-old sister, and there are about 30 people I can call friends. I have a throng of admirers who can't keep their adoring eyes off me, and who sometimes have to resort to using a broken pocket mirror to try and catch a glimpse of me in the classroom. I have a family, loving aunts, and a good home. No, on the surface, I seem to have everything, except my one true friend. All I think about when I'm with friends is having a good time. I can't bring myself to talk about anything but ordinary everyday things. We don't seem to be able to get any closer, and that's the problem. Maybe it's my fault that we don't confide in each other. In any case, that's just how things are, and unfortunately they're not liable to change. This is why I've started the diary. To enhance the image of this long-awaited friend in my imagination, I don't want to jot down the facts in this diary the way most people would do, but I want the diary to be my friend, and I'm going to call this friend Kitty. Since no one would understand a word of my stories to Kitty if I were to plunge right in, I'd better provide a brief sketch of my life, much as I dislike doing so. My father, the most adorable father I've ever seen, didn't marry my mother until he was 36 and she was 25. My sister Margot was born in Frankfurt am Main in Germany in 1926. I was born on June 12, 1929. I lived in Frankfurt until I was 4. Because we're Jewish, my father immigrated to Holland in 1933 when he became the managing director of the Dutch Opetka Company, which manufactures products used in making jam. My mother, Edith Hollander Frank, went with him to Holland in September, while Margot and I were sent to Aachen to stay with our grandmother. Margot went to Holland in December, and I followed in February when I was plunked down on the table as a birthday present for Margot. I started right away at the Montessori Nursery School. I stayed there until I was 6, at which time I started first grade. In 6th grade, my teacher was Mrs. Cooperus, the principal. At the end of the year, we were both in tears as we said a heartbreaking farewell, because I'd been accepted at the Jewish Lyceum, where Margot also went to school. Our lives were not without anxieties, since our relatives in Germany were suffering under Hitler's anti-Jewish laws. After the pogroms in 1938, my two uncles, my mother's brothers, fled Germany, finding safe refuge in North America. My elderly grandmother came to live with us. She was 73 years old at the time. After May 1940, the good times were few and far between. First, there was the war, then the capitulation, and then the arrival of the Germans, which is when the trouble started for the Jews. our freedom was severely restricted by a series of anti-Jewish decrees. Jews were required to wear a yellow star. Jews were required to turn in their bicycles. Jews were forbidden to use streetcars. Jews were forbidden to ride in cars, even their own. Jews were required to do their shopping between 3 and 5 p.m. Jews were required to frequent only Jewish-owned barbershops and beauty parlors. Jews were forbidden to be out on the streets between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Jews were forbidden to go to theaters, movies, or any other forms of entertainment. Jews were forbidden to use swimming pools, tennis courts, hockey fields, or any other athletic fields. Jews were forbidden to go rowing. Jews were forbidden to take part in any athletic activity in public. Jews were forbidden to sit in their gardens or those of their friends after 8 p.m. Jews were forbidden to visit Christians in their homes. Jews were required to attend Jewish schools, etc. You couldn't do this and you couldn't do that, but life went on. Jacques always said to me, "I don't dare do anything anymore, because I'm afraid it's not allowed." In the summer of 1941, Grandma got sick and had to have an operation, so my birthday passed with little celebration. In the summer of 1940, we didn't do much for my birthday either, since the fighting had just ended in Holland. Grandma died in January 1942. No one knows how often I think of her and still love her. This birthday celebration in 1942 was intended to make up for the others, and Grandma's candle was lit along with the rest. The four of us are still doing well, and that brings me to the present date of June 20th, 1942, and the solemn dedication of my diary. Saturday, June 20th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, let me get started right away. It's nice and quiet now. Father and mother are out, and Margot has gone to play ping pong with some other young people at her friend Trace. I've been playing a lot of ping pong myself lately, so much that five of us girls have formed a club. It's called the Little Dipper Minus Two, a really silly name, but it's based on a mistake. We wanted to give our club a special name, and because there were five of us, we came up with the idea of the Little Dipper. We thought it consisted of five stars, but we turned out to be wrong. It has seven, like the Big Dipper, which explains the minus two. Ilse Wagner has a ping pong set, and the Wagners let us play in their big dining room whenever we want. Since we five ping pong players like ice cream, especially in the summer, and since you get hot playing ping pong, our games usually end with a visit to the nearest ice cream parlor that allows Jews, either Oasis or Delphi. We've long since stopped hunting around for our purses or money. Most of the time it's so busy in Oasis that we manage to find a few generous young men of our acquaintance or an admirer to offer us more ice cream than we could eat in a week. You're probably a little surprised to hear me talking about admirers at such a tender age. Unfortunately or not, as the case may be, this vice seems to be rampant at our school. As soon as a boy asks if he can bicycle home with me and we get to talking, 9 times out of 10 I can be sure he'll become enamored on the spot and won't let me out of his sight for a second. His ardor eventually cools, especially since I ignore his passionate glances and pedal blithely on my way. If it gets so bad that they start rambling on about asking Father's permission, I swerve slightly on my bike, my school bag falls, and the young man feels obliged to get off his bike and hand it to me, by which time I've switched the conversation to another topic. These are the most innocent types. Of course, there are those who blow you kisses or try to take hold of your arm, but they're definitely knocking on the wrong door. I get off my bike and either refuse to make further use of their company or act as if I'm insulted and tell them in no uncertain terms to go on home without me. There you are. We've now laid the basis for our friendship. Until tomorrow, yours, Anne. Sunday, June 21st, 1942. Dearest Kitty, our entire class is quaking in its boots. The reason, of course, is the upcoming meeting in which the teachers decide who'll be promoted to the next grade and who'll be kept back. Half the class is making bets. Jeezy and I laugh ourselves sick at the two boys behind us, CN and Jacques Coquernot, who have staked their entire vacation savings on their bet. From morning to night, it's, "You're going to pass. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not." Even G's pleading glances and my angry outbursts can't calm them down. If you ask me, there are so many dummies that about a quarter of the class should be kept back, but teachers are the most unpredictable creatures on earth. Maybe this time they'll be unpredictable in the right direction for a change. I'm not so worried about my girlfriends and myself. We'll make it. The only subject I'm not sure about is math. Anyway, all we can do is wait. Until then, we keep telling each other not to lose heart. I get along pretty well with all my teachers. There are 9 of them, 7 men and 2 women. Mr. Keesing, the old fogey who teaches math, was mad at me for the longest time because I talked so much. After several warnings, he assigned me extra homework, an essay on the subject, a chatterbox. A chatterbox? What can you write about that? I'd worry about that later, I decided. I jotted down the assignment in my notebook, tucked it in my bag, and tried to keep quiet. That evening, after I'd finished the rest of my homework, the note about the essay caught my eye. I began thinking about the subject while chewing the tip of my fountain pen. Anyone could ramble on and leave big spaces between the words, but the trick was to come up with convincing arguments to prove the necessity of talking. I thought and thought, and suddenly I had an idea. I wrote the 3 pages Mr. Keesing had assigned me and was satisfied. I argued that talking is a female trait and that I would do my best to keep it under control, but that I would never be able to break myself of the habit, since my mother talked as much as I did, if not more, and that there's not much you can do about inherited traits. Mr. Keesing had a good laugh at my arguments, but when I proceeded to talk my way through the next class, he assigned me a second essay. This time it was supposed to be on an incorrigible chatterbox. I handed it in, and Mr. Keesing had nothing to complain about for 2 whole classes. However, during the 3rd class, he'd finally had enough. "Anne Frank, as punishment for talking in class, write an essay entitled Quack, Quack, Quack," said Mistress Chatterback. The class roared. I had to laugh, too, though I'd nearly exhausted my ingenuity on the topic of chatterboxes. It was time to come up with something else, something original. My friend Sana, who's good at poetry, offered to help me write the essay from beginning to end in verse. I jumped for joy. Keesing was trying to play a joke on me with this ridiculous subject, but I'd make sure the joke was on him. I finished my poem, and it was beautiful. It was about a mother duck and a father swan with 3 baby ducklings who were bitten to death by the father because they quacked too much. Luckily, Keesing took the joke the right way. He read the poem to the class, adding his own comments, and to several other classes as well. Since then, I've been allowed to talk and haven't been assigned any extra homework. On the contrary, Keesing's always making jokes these days. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, June 24th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, it's sweltering. Everyone is huffing and puffing, and in this heat I have to walk everywhere. Only now do I realize how pleasant a streetcar is, but we Jews are no longer allowed to make use of this luxury. Our own 2 feet are good enough for us. Yesterday at lunchtime I had an appointment with the dentist on Jan Lukasstraat. It's a long way from our school on Stad Stimmertownen. That afternoon I nearly fell asleep at my desk. Fortunately, people automatically offer you something to drink. The dental assistant is really kind. The only mode of transportation left to us is the ferry. The ferryman at Josef Israelkade took us across when we asked him to. It's not the fault of the Dutch that we Jews are having such a bad time. I wish I didn't have to go to school. My bike was stolen during Easter vacation, and Father gave Mother's bike to some Christian friends for safekeeping. Thank goodness summer vacation is almost here. 1 more week and our torment will be over. Something unexpected happened yesterday morning. As I was passing the bicycle racks, I heard my name being called. I turned around, and there was the nice boy I'd met the evening before at my friend Wilma's. He's Wilma's second cousin. I used to think Wilma was nice, which she is, but all she ever talks about is boys, and that gets to be a bore. He came toward me, somewhat shyly, and introduced himself as Halo Silberberg. I was a little surprised and wasn't sure what he wanted, but it didn't take me long to find out. He asked if I would allow him to accompany me to school. As long as you're headed that way, I'll go with you, I said, and so we walked together. Halo is 16 and good at telling all kinds of funny stories. He was waiting for me again this morning, and I expect he will be from now on. Anne. Wednesday, July 1st, 1942. Dearest Kitty, until today I honestly couldn't find the time to write you. I was with friends all day Thursday, we had company on Friday, and that's how it went until today. Halo and I have gotten to know each other very well this past week, and he's told me a lot about his life. He comes from Gelsenkirchen and is living with his grandparents. His parents are in Belgium, but there's no way he can get there. Halo used to have a girlfriend named Ursula. I know her too. She's perfectly sweet and perfectly boring. Ever since he met me, Halo has realized that he's been falling asleep at Ursel's side. So, I'm kind of a pep tonic. Never know what you're good for. Jock spent Saturday night here. Sunday afternoon she was at Henley's, and I was bored stiff. Halo was supposed to come over that evening, but he called around 6. I answered the phone and he said, "This is Helmut Silberberg. May I please speak to Anne?" "Oh, hello, this is Anne." "Oh, hi Anne, how are you?" "Fine, thanks. I just wanted to say I'm sorry, but I can't come tonight, though I would like to have a word with you. Is it all right if I come by and pick you up in about 10 minutes?
"Yes, that's fine. Bye-bye."
"Okay, I'll be right over. Bye-bye." I hung up, quickly changed my clothes, and fixed my hair. I was so nervous I leaned out the window to watch for him. He finally showed up. Miracle of miracles, I didn't rush down the stairs, but waited quietly until he rang the bell. I went down to open the door, and he got right to the point. "Anne, my grandmother thinks you're too young for me to be seeing you on a regular basis. She says I should be going to the Lowenbachs, but you probably know that I'm not going out with Ursel anymore."
"No, I didn't know. What happened? Did you two have a fight?"
"No, nothing like that. I told Ursel that we weren't suited to each other, and so it was better for us not to go together anymore, but that she was welcome at my house, and I hoped I would be welcome at hers. Actually, I thought Ursel was hanging around with another boy, and I treated her as if she were, but that wasn't true. And then my uncle said I should apologize to her, but of course, I didn't feel like it, and that's why I broke up with her. But that was just one of the reasons. Now my grandmother wants me to see Ursel and not you, but I don't agree, and I'm not going to. Sometimes old people have really old-fashioned ideas, but that doesn't mean I have to go along with them. I need my grandparents, but in a certain sense, they need me too. From now on, I'll be free on Wednesday evenings. You see, my grandparents made me sign up for a wood-carving class, but actually, I go to a club organized by the Zionists. My grandparents don't want me to go because they're anti-Zionists. I'm not a fanatic Zionist, but it interests me. Anyway, it's been such a mess lately that I'm planning to quit. So next Wednesday will be my last meeting. That means I can see you Wednesday evening, Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, Sunday afternoon, and maybe even more.
But if your grandparents don't want you to, you shouldn't go behind their backs.
All's fair in love and war. Just then we passed Blancafort's bookstore, and there was Peter Schiff with 2 other boys. It was the first time he'd said hello to me in ages, and it really made me feel good. Monday evening, Halo came over to meet father and mother. I had bought a cake and some candy, and we had tea and cookies, the works, but neither Halo nor I felt like sitting stiffly on our chairs. So we went out for a walk, and he didn't deliver me to my door until 8:10. Father was furious. He said it was very wrong of me not to get home on time. I had to promise to be home by 7:50 in the future. I'd been asked to Halo's on Saturday. Wilma told me that one night when Halo was at her house, she asked him, "Who do you like best, Ursel or Anne?" He said, "It's none of your business." But as he was leaving, they hadn't talked to each other the rest of the evening. He said, "Well, I like Anne better, but don't tell anyone. Bye." And whoosh, he was out the door. In everything he says or does, I can see that Halo is in love with me. And it's kind of nice for a change. Margot would say that Halo is a decent sort. I think so, too. But he's more than that. Mother is also full of praise. A good-looking boy, nice and polite. I'm glad he's so popular with everyone, except with my girlfriends. He thinks they're very childish, and he's right about that. Jacques still teases me about him, but I'm not in love with him. Not really. It's all right for me to have boys as friends. Nobody minds. Mother is always asking me who I'm going to marry when I grow up, but I bet she'll never guess it's Peter, because I talked her out of that idea myself without batting an eyelash. I love Peter as I've never loved anyone, and I tell myself he's only going around with all those other girls to hide his feelings for me. Maybe he thinks Halo and I are in love with each other, which we're not. He's just a friend, or as mother puts it, a beau. Yours, Anne. Sunday, July 5th, 1942. Dear Kitty, the graduation ceremony in the Jewish theater on Friday went as expected. My report card wasn't too bad. I got 1 D, a C- in algebra, and all the rest Bs, except for 2 B+s and 2 B-s. My parents are pleased, but they're not like other parents when it comes to grades. They never worry about report cards, good or bad. As long as I'm healthy and happy and don't talk back too much, they're satisfied. If these 3 things are all right, everything else will take care of itself.
I'm just the opposite. I don't want to be a poor student. I was accepted to the Jewish Lyceum on a conditional basis. I was supposed to stay in the 7th grade at the Montessori school, but when Jewish children were required to go to Jewish schools, Mr. Elta finally agreed, after a great deal of persuasion, to accept Lise Gosler and me. Lise also passed this year, though she has to repeat her geometry exam. Poor Lise. It isn't easy for her to study at home. Her baby sister, a spoiled little 2-year-old, plays in her room all day. If Gabby doesn't get her way, she starts screaming, and if Lise doesn't look after her, Mrs. Gosler starts screaming. So Lise has a hard time doing her homework, and as long as that's the case, the tutoring she's been getting won't help much. The Gosler household is really a sight. Mrs. Gosler's parents live next door but eat with the family. Then there's a hired girl, the baby, the always absent-minded and absent Mr. Gosler, and the always nervous and irritable Mrs. Gosler, who's expecting another baby. Lise, who's all thumbs, gets lost in the mayhem. My sister Margot has also gotten her report card. Brilliant as usual. If we had such a thing as cum laude, she would have passed with honors. She's so smart. Father has been home a lot lately. There's nothing for him to do at the office. It must be awful to feel you're not needed. Mr. Kleiman has taken over Opetka and Mr. Kugler Geese and Company, the company dealing in spices and spice substitutes that was set up in 1941. A few days ago, as we were taking a stroll around our neighborhood square, Father began to talk about going into hiding. He said it would be very hard for us to live cut off from the rest of the world. I asked him why he was bringing this up now. "Well, Anne," he replied, "you know that for more than a year we've been bringing clothes, food, and furniture to other people. We don't want our belongings to be seized by the Germans, nor do we want to fall into their clutches ourselves, so we'll leave of our own accord and not wait to be hauled away." "But when, Father?" He sounded so serious that I felt scared. "Don't you worry, we'll take care of everything. Just enjoy your carefree life while you can." That was it. Oh, may these somber words not come true for as long as possible. The doorbell's ringing. Halo's here. Time to stop. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, July 8th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, it seems like years since Sunday morning. So much has happened, it's as if the whole world has suddenly turned upside down. But as you can see, Kitty, I'm still alive, and that's the main thing. Father says, "I'm alive all right, but don't ask where or how." You probably don't understand a word I'm saying today, so I'll begin by telling you what happened Sunday afternoon. At 3 o'clock, Halo had left but was supposed to come back later. The doorbell rang. I didn't hear it since I was out on the balcony lazily reading in the sun. A little while later, Margot appeared in the kitchen doorway looking very agitated. "Father has received a call-up notice from the SS," she whispered. "Mother has gone to see Mr. Van Dam." Mr. Van Dam is Father's business partner and a good friend. I was stunned. A call-up? Everyone knows what that means. Visions of concentration camps and lonely cells raced through my head. How could we let Father go to such a fate? "Of course he's not going," declared Margot as we waited for Mother in the living room. "Mother's gone to Mr. Van Dam to ask whether we can move to our hiding place tomorrow. The Van Dams are going with us. There will be 7 of us altogether." Silence. We couldn't speak. The thought of Father off visiting someone in the Jewish hospital and completely unaware of what was happening, the long wait for Mother, the heat, the suspense, all this reduced us to silence. Suddenly the doorbell rang again. "That's Halo," I said. "Don't open the door," exclaimed Margot to stop me, but it wasn't necessary since we heard Mother and Mr. Van Dam downstairs talking to Halo, and then the two of them came inside and shut the door behind them. Every time the bell rang, either Margot or I had to tiptoe downstairs to see if it was Father, and we didn't let anyone else in. Margot and I were sent from the room, as Mr. Van Dam wanted to talk to Mother alone. When she and I were sitting in our bedroom, Margot told me that the call-up was not for Father, but for her. At this second shock, I began to cry. Margot is 16. Apparently they want to send girls her age away on their own. But thank goodness she won't be going. Mother had said so herself, which must be what Father had meant when he talked to me about our going into hiding. Hiding. Where would we hide? In the city? In the country? In a house? In a shack? When? Where? How? These were questions I wasn't allowed to ask, but they still kept running through my mind. Margot and I started packing our most important belongings into a school bag. The first thing I stuck in was this diary, and then curlers, handkerchiefs, school books, a comb, and some old letters. Preoccupied by the thought of going into hiding, I stuck the craziest things in the bag, but I'm not sorry. Memories mean more to me than dresses. Father finally came home around 5 o'clock, and we called Mr. Kleiman to ask if he could come by that evening. Mr. Van Dan left and went to get Meep. Meep arrived and promised to return later that night, taking with her a bag full of shoes, dresses, jackets, underwear, and stockings. After that, it was quiet in our apartment. None of us felt like eating. It was still hot, and everything was very strange. We had rented our big upstairs room to a Mr. Goldschmidt, a divorced man in his 30s who apparently had nothing to do that evening, since despite all our polite hints, he hung around until 10 o'clock. Meep and Jan Gies came at 11. Meep, who's worked for Father's company since 1933, has become a close friend, and so has her husband Jan. Once again, shoes, stockings, books, and underwear disappeared into Meep's bag in Jan's deep pockets. At 11:30, they too disappeared. I was exhausted, and even though I knew it'd be my last night in my own bed, I fell asleep right away and didn't wake up until Mother called me at 5:30 the next morning. Fortunately, it wasn't as hot as Sunday. A warm rain fell throughout the day. The four of us were wrapped in so many layers of clothes it looked as if we were going off to spend the night in a refrigerator, and all that just so we could take more clothes with us. No Jew in our situation would dare leave the house with a suitcase full of clothes. I was wearing 2 undershirts, 3 pairs of underpants, a dress, and over that a skirt, a jacket, a raincoat, 2 pairs of stockings, heavy shoes, a cap, a scarf, and lots more. I was suffocating even before we left the house, but no one bothered to ask me how I felt. Margot stuffed her school bag with school books, went to get her bicycle, and with Meep leading the way, rode off into the great unknown. At any rate, that's how I thought of it, since I still didn't know where our hiding place was. At 7:30, we two closed the door behind us. Mortia, my cat, was the only living creature I said goodbye to. According to a note we left for Mr. Goldschmidt, she was to be taken to the neighbors who would give her a good home. The stripped beds, the breakfast things on the table, the pound of meat for the cat in the kitchen, all of these created the impression that we'd left in a hurry. But we weren't interested in impressions. We just wanted to get out of there, to get away and reach our destination in safety. Nothing else mattered. More tomorrow. Yours, Anne. Thursday, July 9th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, so there we were, Father, Mother, and I, walking in the pouring rain, each of us with a school bag and a shopping bag filled to the brim with the most varied assortment of items. The people on their way to work at that early hour gave us sympathetic looks. You could tell by their faces that they were sorry they couldn't offer us some kind of transportation. The conspicuous yellow star spoke for itself. Only when we were walking down the street did Father and Mother reveal, little by little, what the plan was. For months, we'd been moving as much of our furniture and apparel out of the apartment as we could. It was agreed that we'd go into hiding on July 16th. Because of Margot's call-up notice, the plan had to be moved up 10 days, which meant we'd have to make do with less orderly rooms. The hiding place was located in Father's office building. That's a little hard for outsiders to understand, so I'll explain. Father didn't have a lot of people working in his office, just Mr. Kugler, Mr. Kleiman, Meep, and a 23-year-old typist named Bep Foskel, all of whom were informed of our coming. Mr. Foskel, Bep's father, works in the warehouse, along with 2 assistants, none of whom were told anything. Here's a description of the building. The large warehouse on the ground floor is used as a workroom and storeroom and is divided into several different sections, such as the stockroom and the milling room, where cinnamon, cloves, and a pepper substitute are ground. Next to the warehouse doors is another outside door, a separate entrance to the office. Just inside the office door is a second door, and beyond that, a stairway. At the top of the stairs is another door with a frosted window on which the word office is written in black letters. This is the big front office. Very large, very light, and very full. Bep, Meep, and Mr. Kleiman work there during the day. After passing through an alcove containing a safe, a wardrobe, and a big supply cupboard, you come to the small, dark, stuffy back office. This used to be shared by Mr. Kugler and Mr. Van Dan, but now Mr. Kugler is its only occupant. Mr. Kugler's office can also be reached from the hallway, but only through a glass door that can be opened from the inside, but not easily from the outside. If you leave Mr. Kugler's office and proceed through the long, narrow hallway, past the coal bin, and go up 4 steps, you find yourself in the private office, the showpiece of the entire building. Elegant mahogany furniture, a linoleum floor covered with throw rugs, a radio, a fancy lamp, everything first class. Next door is a spacious kitchen with a hot water heater and 2 gas burners, and beside that a bathroom. That's the second floor. A wooden staircase leads from the downstairs hallway to the 3rd floor. At the top of the stairs is a landing, with doors on either side. The door on the left takes you up to the spice storage area, attic and loft in the front part of the house. A typically Dutch, very steep, ankle-twisting flight of stairs also runs from the front part of the house to another door opening onto the street. The door to the right of the landing leads to the secret annex at the back of the house. No one would ever suspect there were so many rooms behind that plain gray door. There's just 1 small step in front of the door, and then you're inside. Straight ahead of you is a steep flight of stairs. To the left is a narrow hallway opening onto a room that serves as the Frank family's living room and bedroom. Next door is a smaller room, the bedroom and study of the 2 young ladies of the family. To the right of the stairs is a windowless washroom with a sink. The door in the corner leads to the toilet and another one to Margot's and my room. If you go up the stairs and open the door at the top, you're surprised to see such a large, light, and spacious room in an old canal-side house like this. It contains a stove, thanks to the fact that it used to be Mr. Kugler's laboratory, and a sink. This will be the kitchen and bedroom of Mr. and Mrs. Van Dan, as well as the general living room, dining room, and study for us all. A tiny side room is to be Peter Van Dan's bedroom. Then, just as in the front part of the building, there's an attic and a loft. So there you are. Now I've introduced you to the whole of our lovely annex. Yours, Anne. Friday, July 10th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, I've probably bored you with my long description of our house, but I still think you should know where I've ended up. How I ended up here is something you'll figure out from my next letters. But first, let me continue my story, because as you know, I wasn't finished. After we arrived at 263 Prinsengracht, Miep quickly led us through the long hallway and up the wooden staircase to the next floor and into the annex. She shut the door behind us, leaving us alone. Margot had arrived much earlier on her bike and was waiting for us. Our living room and all the other rooms were so full of stuff that I can't find the words to describe it. All the cardboard boxes that had been sent to the office in the last few months were piled on the floors and beds. The small room was filled from floor to ceiling with linens. If we wanted to sleep in properly made beds that night, we had to get going and straighten up the mess. Mother and Margot were unable to move a muscle. They lay down on their bare mattresses, tired, miserable, and I don't know what else. But Father and I, the 2 cleaner-uppers in the family, started in right away. All day long, we unpacked boxes, filled cupboards, hammered nails, and straightened up the mess until we fell exhausted into our clean beds at night. We hadn't eaten a hot meal all day, but we didn't care. Mother and Margot were too tired and keyed up to eat, and Father and I were too busy. Tuesday morning, we started where we left off the night before. Bep and Meep went grocery shopping with our ration coupons. Father worked on our blackout screens. We scrubbed the kitchen floor and were once again busy from sunup to sundown. Until Wednesday, I didn't have a chance to think about the enormous change in my life. Then, for the first time since our arrival in the secret annex, I found a moment to tell you all about it and to realize what had happened to me and what was yet to happen. Yours, Anne. Saturday, July 11th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Father, Mother, and Margot still can't get used to the chiming of the Vester Torah clock, which tells us the time every 1/4 hour. Not me. I liked it from the start. It sounds so reassuring, especially at night. You no doubt want to hear what I think of being in hiding. Well, all I can say is that I don't really know yet. I don't think I'll ever feel at home in this house, but that doesn't mean I hate it. It's more like being on vacation in some strange pension. Kind of an odd way to look at life in hiding, but that's how things are. The annex is an ideal place to hide in. It may be damp and lopsided, but there's probably not a more comfortable hiding place in all of Amsterdam. No, in all of Holland. Up to now, our bedroom, with its blank walls, was very bare. Thanks to Father, who brought my entire postcard and movie star collection here beforehand, and to a brush and a pot of glue, I was able to plaster the walls with pictures. It looks much more cheerful. When the Van Dans arrive, we'll be able to build cupboards and other odds and ends out of the wood piled in the attic. Margot and Mother have recovered somewhat. Yesterday, Mother felt well enough to cook split pea soup for the first time, but then she was downstairs talking and forgot all about it. The beans were scorched black, and no amount of scraping could get them out of the pan. Last night, the four of us went down to the private office and listened to England on the radio. I was so scared someone might hear it that I literally begged Father to take me back upstairs. Mother understood my anxiety and went with me. Whatever we do, we're very afraid the neighbors might hear or see us. We started off immediately the first day sewing curtains. Actually, you can hardly call them that, since they're nothing but scraps of fabric varying greatly in shape, quality, and pattern, which Father and I stitched crookedly together with unskilled fingers. These works of art were tacked to the windows, where they'll stay until we come out of hiding. The building on our right is a branch of the Keg Company, a firm from Zaandam, and on the left is a furniture workshop. Though the people who work there are not on the premises after hours, any sound we make might travel through the walls. We've forbidden Margot to cough at night, even though she has a bad cold, and are giving her large doses of codeine. I'm looking forward to the arrival of the Van Dans, which is set for Tuesday. It will be much more fun, and also not as quiet. You see, it's the silence that makes me so nervous during the evenings and nights, and I'd give anything to have one of our helpers sleep here. It's really not that bad here, since we can do our own cooking and can listen to the radio in Daddy's office. Mr. Kleiman and Meep and Bep Voskel, too, have helped us so much. We've already canned loads of rhubarb, strawberries, and cherries, so for the time being, I doubt we'll be bored. We also have a supply of reading material, and we're going to buy lots of games. Of course, we can't ever look out the window or go outside, and we have to be quiet so the people downstairs can't hear us. Yesterday, we had our hands full. We had to pit 2 crates of cherries for Mr. Kugler to can. We're going to use the empty crates to make bookshelves. Someone's calling me. Yours, Anne. Comment added by Anne on September 28, 1942. Not being able to go outside upsets me more than I can say, and I'm terrified our hiding place will be discovered and that we'll be shot. That, of course, is a fairly dismal prospect. Sunday, July 12, 1942. They were all so nice to me a month ago because of my birthday, and yet every day I feel myself drifting further away from Mother and Margot. I worked hard today, and they praised me, only to start picking on me again 5 minutes later. You can easily see the difference between the way they deal with Margot and the way they deal with me. For example, Margot broke the vacuum cleaner, and because of that, we've been without light for the rest of the day. Mother said, "Well, Margot, it's easy to see you're not used to working. Otherwise, you'd have known better than to yank the plug out by the cord." Margot made some reply, and that was the end of the story. But this afternoon, when I wanted to rewrite something on Mother's shopping list because her handwriting is so hard to read, she wouldn't let me. She bawled me out again, and the whole family wound up getting involved. I don't fit in with them, and I felt that clearly in the last few weeks. They're so sentimental together, but I'd rather be sentimental on my own. They're always saying how nice it is with the four of us and that we get along so well, without giving a moment's thought to the fact that I don't feel that way. Daddy's the only one who understands me, now and again, though he usually sides with Mother and Margot. Another thing I can't stand is having them talk about me in front of outsiders, telling them how I cried or how sensibly I'm behaving. It's horrible, and sometimes they talk about Mortia, and I can't take that at all. Mortia is my weak spot. I miss her every minute of the day, and no one knows how often I think of her. Whenever I do, my eyes fill with tears. Mortia is so sweet, and I love her so much that I keep dreaming she'll come back to us. I have plenty of dreams, but the reality is that we'll have to stay here until the war is over. We can't ever go outside, and the only visitors we can have are Meep, her husband Jan, Bep Voskel, Mr. Kugler, Mr. Kleiman, and Mrs. Kleiman, though she hasn't come because she thinks it's too dangerous. Comment added by Anne in September 1942. Daddy's always so nice. He understands me perfectly, and I wish we could have a heart-to-heart talk sometimes without my bursting instantly into tears, but apparently that has to do with my age. I'd like to spend all my time writing, but that would probably get boring. Up to now, I've only confided my thoughts to my diary. I still haven't gotten around to writing amusing sketches that I could read aloud at a later date. In the future, I'm going to devote less time to sentimentality and more time to reality. Friday, August 14th, 1942. Dear Kitty, I've deserted you for an entire month, but so little has happened that I can't find a newsworthy item to relate every single day. The Van Dans arrived on July 13th. We thought they were coming on the 14th, but from the 13th to 16th, the Germans were sending out call-up notices right and left and causing a lot of unrest, so they decided it would be safer to leave a day too early than a day too late. Peter Van Dan arrived at 9:30 in the morning, while we were still at breakfast. Peter's going on 16, a shy, awkward boy whose company won't amount to much. Mr. and Mrs. Van Dan came half an hour later. Much to our amusement, Mrs. Van Dan was carrying a hat box with a large chamber pot inside. "I just don't feel at home without my chamber pot," she exclaimed, and it was the first item to find a permanent place under the divan. Instead of a chamber pot, Mr. Van D was lugging a collapsible tea table under his arm. From the first, we ate our meals together, and after 3 days, it felt as if the seven of us had become one big family. Naturally, the Van Dans had much to tell about the week we'd been away from civilization. We were especially interested in what had happened to our apartment and to Mr. Goldschmidt. Mr. Van Dan filled us in. Monday morning at 9, Mr. Goldschmidt phoned and asked if I could come over. I went straight away and found a very distraught Mr. Goldschmidt. He showed me a note that the Frank family had left behind. As instructed, he was planning to bring the cat to the neighbors, which I agreed was a good idea. He was afraid the house was going to be searched, so we went through all the rooms, straightening up here and there and clearing the breakfast things off the table. Suddenly, I saw a notepad on Mrs. Frank's desk with an address in Maastricht written on it. Even though I knew Mrs. Frank had left it on purpose, I pretended to be surprised and horrified and begged Mr. Goldschmidt to burn this incriminating piece of paper. I swore up and down that I knew nothing about your disappearance, but that the note had given me an idea. "Mr. Goldschmidt," I said, "I bet I know what this address refers to. About 6 months ago, a high-ranking officer came to the office. It seems he and Mr. Frank grew up together. He promised to help Mr. Frank if it was ever necessary. As I recall, he was stationed in Maastricht. I think this officer has kept his word and is somehow planning to help them cross over to Belgium and then to Switzerland. There's no harm in telling this to any friends of the Franks who come asking about them, of course. You don't need to mention the part about Maastricht." And after that, I left. This is the story most of your friends have been told, because I heard it later from several other people. We thought it was extremely funny, but we laughed even harder when Mr. Van Dan told us that certain people have vivid imaginations. For example, one family living on our square claimed they saw all four of us riding by on our bikes early in the morning, and another woman was absolutely positive we'd been loaded into some kind of military vehicle in the middle of the night. Yours, Anne. Friday, August 21st, 1942. Dear Kitty, now our secret annex has truly become secret. Because so many houses are being searched for hidden bicycles, Mr. Kugler thought it would be better to have a bookcase built in front of the entrance to our hiding place. It swings out on its hinges and opens like a door. Mr. Foskell did the carpentry work. Mr. Foskell has been told that the seven of us are in hiding, and he's been most helpful. Now, whenever we want to go downstairs, we have to duck and then jump. After the first 3 days, we were all walking around with bumps on our foreheads from banging our heads against the low doorway. Then Peter cushioned it by nailing a towel stuffed with wood shavings to the doorframe. Let's see if it helps. I'm not doing much schoolwork. I've given myself a vacation until September. Father wants to start tutoring me then, but we have to buy all the books first. There's little change in our lives here. Peter's hair was washed today, but that's nothing special. Mr. Van Dan and I are always at loggerheads with each other. Mama always treats me like a baby, which I can't stand. For the rest, things are going better. I don't think Peter's gotten any nicer. He's an obnoxious boy who lies around on his bed all day, only rousing himself to do a little carpentry work before returning to his nap. What a dope. Mama gave me another one of her dreadful sermons this morning. We take the opposite view of everything. Daddy's a sweetheart. He may get mad at me, but it never lasts longer than 5 minutes. It's a beautiful day outside, nice and hot. And in spite of everything, We make the most of the weather by lounging on the folding bed in the attic. Yours, Anne. Comment added by Anne on September 21st, 1942. Mr. Van Dan has been as nice